Accession number 9893, Rule 3.
Brigadier Montague Champion Jones, Rule 3. What happened after your return from leave?
Well, after I returned from leave, in January, I had orders to go to GHQ at Elf, because they'd asked for people who, volunteers, who wanted to be trained and inspected, as it were, suitability for brigade major. And, of course, that's a sort of the plum job any keen soldier, staff officer, would wish to have, and to the intense annoyance of the people who felt the movement control, that sort of thing, was an essential part of the of an army. Didn't like all our the latest staff college chaps like me saying they wanted to go and do this. So off we went to Arras, spent a night in Paris, and all the snow on the ground, the cold weather, and that was all quite pleasant. And we were nicely looked after in Paris. Movement control had got settled in, and I met up with a chap who's since become a general, I met recently, who was also going there, and we went out to a theatre, the Folies Bergères, of course, because as we didn't speak any French, it was the only thing we could understand. And we duly arrived in Arras later on, where I joined what was called a general staff officer, grade 3, of staff duties and training, headed by Lord Bridgman, who was then Lieutenant Colonel, was later on, I believe, head of the Home Army, what do they call it?
The Home Guard.
The Home Guard, yes, I think. We settled into the hardest work I've ever known. Staff duties and training was a branch of the general staff, which was responsible for seeing the things from the staff point of view, as opposed to the quartermaster general's point of view, everything went right. For an example of the silliest sort of things, you never knew what was going to come your way. And later on, some women, ATS I suppose they were coming out, and we had to lay down the scale of equipment for them. And the question arose, rather tongue-in-cheek, I think, were these women to have rifles, you see, or any sort of arms? And so we sent a message across to A branch, who was responsible for saying that sort of thing, as to would they carry any form of arms. The reply came back, no, we suggest rolling pins for cross combat work. It's rather like the Navy, they're always sending off signals to each other, that sort of thing. Anyway, the branch I joined had Robert Bridgman as one, as the head of the General Staff Officer of Grade 1, and he had one Grade 2 Major and one Lieutenant, Grade 3. And they had not had an hour off during the 3 months they'd been there. Their work was so much and so heavy. We started on parade after breakfast at 8:30 in the morning, and if we got away from that office by 2 o'clock at night, we were very, very lucky indeed. And they hadn't had an afternoon. Those three hadn't had an afternoon or a day off. So we then got another major and myself, which made 5 officers, and for a month or two at least, we never had an hour off, and still never got home before about 2 o'clock in the morning. It's unbelievable the amount of paperwork that we had to do. And you see, Lord Bridgman went out in his car and made contact with the troops arrived. It was all part of the seeing that the arrival and getting the troops in their right places as battalion after battalion came out. Worked smoothly, and all sorts of funny questions came up. I remember working very late at night because a very senior officer had asked the awkward question, how many rifles are there in a division? Well, to find out how many rifles there were in a division, you first of all had to know who didn't carry a rifle. You then had to get the war established of every unit in a division, which is about 15,000 troops in those days, I think, and calculated guess by guess and otherwise how many rifles there were. What that was for, I don't know, but it kept me working several nights late, I know that. And whether I was anywhere near right, I have no idea. But all that sounded a waste of time, but it wasn't. And I said, people used to say the staff duties, SD, stood for stirring department. It pushed people into doing this, that, and the other, you see, really. Well, then, nothing more really happened to that, to us there.
Did you travel around at all, or were you based in the office all the time?
I got out once or twice. I managed to get the colonel's car, a staff car, and I went out to visit my old unit, which had passed through my hands at Cherbourg. And that was how I heard that the mobilization plan, which I prepared, went well. And the same commander was there, and I went out and saw them and had a chat with them and that sort of thing, which was a pleasant break. It was a Sunday. It always... there's a very amusing story at that time. When... Lord Gort went out with the French to view the ground which is going to be taken over by the next division coming out on the right. And they went down a hedge. and he said, they had a map, beautiful maps. The French produced wonderful maps, beautifully drawn. They had wonderful draftsmen showing all the defences that were going to the next stage on the right. And so he got out his map and said, I think we should stop here. This must be about where these lines are. And they climbed up a bank and they looked over the fence. And he said, but where are the defences? Virgin fields, no, all perfect agriculture, nothing happening at all. And he asked where. And the fence said, oh, that's an exist bar. They do not exist. They are all en projet. Now, it's rather interesting. I was reading this book on all about Churchill, the finest hour. Yeah. And Churchill was so impressed when he went out there by that in the British sector, all was bustle and business, whereas in the French sector, nothing seemed to be happening. It rather, that lends a point to that particular story. And it's not surprising, really.
Did you encounter any difficulties in dealing with the French in your own work, in organising movements?
Not really, no. We had a certain amount of contact with the French. We had a French liaison officer. General Georges was the French commander in our area. I think the contacts with the French came at a much higher level, really. The only difficulty was, as extra troops arrived in Arras, the difficulty was to get the French town authorities to give up billets and that sort of thing. And mostly places that richer people had left, gone away. Well, that period was long and rather tedious, about 3 months. And then in May, the balloon went up. The first thing we knew about it was that one night an aeroplane came over. I looked out of my billet window and I saw the shadow of the stars of this thing. Next moment there was a crash, and about 200 yards away a bomb fell in a crater. I didn't stay looking out of that window for long. next thing that happened was a crash, and a French motorcyclist had gone in the dark into the crater. And after that, some incendiary bombs were dropped on the old houses fairly near where I was, and Arras went up in flames.
Had you had any intimation that there was going to be an attack?
No, you see, they hadn't even started to march into Holland and Belgium then. That comes later. Anyway, I was told to pack up my bag and my bedding room, come and live in the big civic hall where our headquarters was. It's got a name. I can't remember what it's called. And so I slept on the floor in there, and we got our clerks, if it was rifles and things like that, and took up defensive positions in case parachutists arrive. And then a few days later, I was our own branch staff duties closed down, and we went and joined up with the operations branch, our opposite numbers. And one night I was a duty officer there, and we got news from French and Paris. Message came through that there was a lot of activity on the Dutch border. It looked as though something was happening, but they didn't think it really meant much because too many lights were showing. There was no attempt at secrecy or anything like that. And we waited, and a bit later, further messages came through that the Germans were invading Holland. And so it fell to me to wake up our general staff, our colonel, who afterwards became a general, and get him to come round. And we waited and saw what was happening, and eventually, I don't know, the message came through that the plans for the British expedition force to move forward to take up the positions which had been envisaged, but no work done on them, on the line of the Dyle in Belgium, and we had a code word for that. So I was deputed to get onto the two corps and give the code word for the whole of the British expeditionary force to go forward. Questionable wisdom, but politics really made us do the wrong thing probably there. And nothing much happened after that. We were left in peace in our rear headquarters in Arras, recording the messages that came in and that sort of thing. Then one day I was sent for by RG1, who and asked what I was doing, and I told him I was only keeping up the war diary, which was, he said, well, that's not important. You ought to be brigade major. Here is your brigadier, and here are four boys, anti-tank rifles, five boys, anti-tank rifles. He's going out to, he wants a trained staff officer to act as brigade major, and and join his headquarters at Doulos, a place about 15 miles south of Arras, where his territorial battalions were arriving at that time. So I got in, I got my bag and baggage and got into his car, and off we went. His brigade was consisted of three battalions from territorials from the Kentish regiments, the 5th and 6th Buffs, and the 7th Royal West Kents, if I remember rightly. They had been low priority, untrained troops. They'd learnt to shoot rifles on the rifle range, and that was about all, who'd been sent out during the phony war to dig, act as labour and dig landing grounds and that sort of thing in the rear for the RAF. And I remember that it came through our office, special instructions, they were not allowed to get anywhere near the enemy or any fighting. They were going to go back home for further training later on. But our office hadn't envisaged the fighting getting near them, which was more or less what was really happening. Anyway, they'd got into a lot. Anybody who had driven a car or anything else, because they had no transport of their own, but they were provided with it from somewhere. So these splendid chaps, they found anybody who'd driven anything, they put him in the lorry, and they all drove up to Doulon. So when I got there, the 7th Royal West Kents had gone forward to hold, I can't remember the name of the town, a map would tell us, in advance, and the two other battalions were in Doulon's. And we had no signals, only a dispatch rider, and 15 miles is quite a long way off from your headquarters. And when we got there, we set up our headquarters in a house in the town. And the first thing that happened was this Royal West Kent's battalion reported to us that there were tanks in the town where they were supposed to go, German tanks. And we reported this to headquarters Peter Force, it was called, in Arras. And they sent back, "Oh, no tanks within miles, go back into the town." And the upshot of that was a territorial army, very untrained, got into that with our only two pieces of artillery, two 18-pounder guns, and walked straight into the town square to be surrounded by Germans. So that was the end of one whole battalion, written off at once, all taken prisoners of war, and our only two guns to fight tanks with. Well, then, the next day we stayed there, and we drew up our only operation order. We got final orders from Peter Force to hold the line of the railway. That was all against my staff college training, but with only five boys, anti-tank rifles, you couldn't really make much impression on what were, in fact, Rommel's tanks. And we decided to move out of Doulens and establish our headquarters in a village in some woods a bit further north. And the two battalions took up positions along the road that ran the Arras-Doulens road. And we waited events. And the German tanks arrived, a certain amount of shooting went on. One German staff car drove to the main road of our village. We were in a deserted chateau, they'd have called it, as a high-class house, where they'd left a lovely cellar for us. We didn't get ourselves drunk or anything like that, but we did have some very nice lunch on their wine, and which the Germans would have been delighted to find, I'm sure, later on. A German staff car came through, and at our gate, it had a wall, and there was a sort of stone bridge over the road coming off from our ground. And the chap was, we'd posted a German anti-tank man with an anti-tank rifle at the gate in the wall. He had his rifle poking through. And a German staff car arrived, and he let off one loose round at it, which I don't know what damage he did. It probably was very unpleasant. And the staff car withdrew. And later on, a tank came down there and started shooting, but they didn't know where we were, fortunately. And as dusk was falling, we could see this trace of bullets going right down the valley behind. And one of our battalions, the reserve battalion, fell back on our headquarters. And by that time, our brigadier had given orders to the two battalions front to try and withdraw and try and get away, because we couldn't really hold that position. And he said he'd lost one brigade in the First World War. He wasn't going to lose another one in this. And so when this tank came along, we up sticks, and we went out and hid in the wood, because we thought it was no good staying in this place. So we had one company and ourselves there. And we really waited for nightfall, because we hoped to get back and join up perhaps with our own troops or something like that. And we couldn't cross this road while the tanks were firing down it. So we hid in the wood till night fell in this company, and then eventually moved across and moved off westwards. And we walked through the wood. Occasionally, some rather trigger-happy chap would let off a rifle, which rather shook us, but he didn't hit anybody. And eventually heard transport on a road ahead. So the brigadier said, "Well, wait here, I'll go forward and reconnoitre and see who they are. If they're our troops, we might be able to get a lift away somewhere." He went forward and came back very dejected and said, they're Germans. There's no possible hope of getting a party this size through. Collect everybody and tell them to what the situation is, and tell them to break up into the smallest possible parties, and some individuals might get away. Go in that direction as best you can, hide in the woods, and that sort of thing. And that's it, more or less. So we did that, and I went on, not knowing any of the troops or anything like that. There's no point in my going with them. The colonel of one of the battalions and his adjutant joined me, and I think they joined me because I had a map, and we went off and hid in the nearby woods for the rest of the night. And from the map we chose various woods, and we, for the next 6 days, the three of us walked westwards, hiding up in the early morning and hiding up by day in woods where there's a thickness, and moving by night. We're moving by night. It was fairly favourable weather, the moonlight and the nice mist which hid one and yet enabled you to see. But the trouble with the French villages, there were hidden barbed wire fences and that sort of thing to keep sheep and cattle in, and most of these villages by then were deserted. And so it was quite a struggle finding our way through. We did that for six days and ended up eventually in near Abbeville Aerodrome. Events on the way worth relating. In one place, two or three days. The first thing we learnt, I must say, was that even in May it can be jolly cold outside. We only had our battle dress, no overcoat or anything like that, and probably summer underclothing, I don't know. And the first thing we learnt was to find a haystack and get armfuls of hay before you went into the wood, and put even a few a thin covering of straw makes an extraordinarily warm covering. Then we laid up in the thickest part of any wood we could find. Sometimes we had German tanks rumbling past us during the night within a few feet of our heads one night. On another occasion we went into a big wood which was astride a valley. We found the ground thickest on the hillside west of the valley, and when we got up in the morning we were appalled to hear Germans on the other side of the valley in the wood singing their marching songs. German troops were, it is quite remarkable, which I'm sure that our troops wouldn't do that in this sort of thing, how they spent their entire time singing these wonderful marching songs where they're far and gegen England and that sort of thing. So we hoped they wouldn't come our side, which they didn't, and we stayed where we were for the day. And by evening we went out into a field with ideas of, we saw a wood fairly near, and we thought we'd go into that, but one of us went forward to have a look and came quickly back, crouching low in the fog, so it's full of tanks. So we went in the other direction and found another wood somewhere else. The only other occasion worth recording of these 6 nights was we were getting very short of food, and we went in the back gardens of the village, tried to get some help from the French. We had some money, but they wouldn't look us, so we didn't want to be in trouble. By which time the main road which they were facing on was carrying a lot of German transport going forward, and so we walked up a sunken lane on the south side of the road, where we found a chap who turned out to be a Pole. His head appeared from a field over a fence, and so we managed to, he spoke enough French, we had some French money, so we gave him some money to go into the village to get us some food, and he came back with a large ham, a lot of dog biscuits and various other things which were very, very useful to us. And so we went into the wood the other side of the sunken lane from him, and we lay down. The only thick, it was a wood of tall trees with very little undergrowth, the only thick undergrowth was the other side of the hedge from the sunken lane, very near to the lane. So we lay down there and composed ourselves to sleep for the rest of the day. Very soon afterwards a futfut and a German, I don't know how we knew it was German, I think nobody else, nothing but a German would have been moving, a motorcycle which we guessed to be a machine gun motorcycle, came to rest, obviously as a flank guard to the main column, came to rest in this sunken lane, only about 10 feet from our heads. There we were for the rest of the day, unable to move or sneeze without giving away. And so we stayed there the rest of the day. In the evening it came on to rain, we got very wet, and Eventually we heard the motorcycling disappear, and we were able to feel dark and we were able to move. We were very wet, and we decided the best way to cross this heavily trafficked road was to go under a bridge and up a stream through the village. This was a rather wet proceeding and a smelly proceeding, because it was really the main drain of the village. We came out of that on the north side of the village and went through a field which had, we sank up to our knees in deep ruts. I don't know what the field was for. It was very heavy going. And eventually we came out, instead of going to the wood, which we had marked from the map, near Avila Aerodrome, we saw an abandoned British hut, RAF hut, in the middle of a field. We went into this, and being extremely war-wise, as you might say, commando-wise, we went into this hut, found coke and a stove and some beds, so we took off our wet trousers, lit a fire, and hung them up by the stove to dry. And in the morning, we didn't keep a lookout, and of course, if we'd been at all sensible, nobody in the senses would have gone in there, because there was no escape with the open field all round. And we heard a lorry stop on the road, and our adjutant got up and looked out of the window, and he said, it's a lorry, it's a German lorry, some troops getting out of it. Good God, we're coming here. And they walked in and found three British officers standing there with no trousers on. And that is how we were taken prisoner. We were taken to the wood, which we intended to go into, which turned out to be the wagon lines of an anti-aircraft unit. We had heard in the morning, we'd been woken up by the anti-aircraft guns going off on the other side of us. So we were really in the best position we could have been, I suppose.
Except had you been armed at all?
We had our revolvers, which we handed over, shamedly, to them. Nothing else we could do. And the other thing happened with that they took us to their headquarters, which was, I think, in Abbeville. And there's a certain amount of nastiness because our adjutant chappie had been issued with the old-fashioned 4-5 revolver and lead bullets, which was against the Geneva Convention. Fortunately, mine were the later ones, which were nickel-covered bullets. And they looked rather shirty at this. Fortunately, he didn't know this, but I was able to explain that these had only been issued to railroad troops for practice purposes. They weren't expected to be fired in anger at all. And so they didn't, they accepted that. You never know when you've suddenly been taken prisoner and your captors begin to look nasty. You never quite know what's going to happen.